mutual aid in an era when governments fail to do their job.
I think about mutual aid as the part of social movement work where we are meeting each other's direct needs, survival needs, with a shared understanding that the systems in place have created the crises that we're facing and or are worsening them, and that we need to do it for ourselves.
That's Dean Spade. We talk with him about his book, Mutual Aid, Building Solidarity During This Crisis and the Next. Then, at a time when domestic violence is skyrocketing, we re-air our 2019 interview with Rachel Louise Snyder. Her book is No Visible Bruises. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. In-depth conversation with writers of all genres on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. When the Texas electrical grid went down and millions lost heat, water, and food, mutual aid came to the rescue. From fellow residents to already established mutual aid organizations to a certain congresswoman from New York, people rallied to help those in need. But my guest, Dean Spade, says mutual aid is more than just springing into action during disasters. It is the radical act of caring for each other while working to change the world for the better. His new book, Mutual Aid, is about why mutual aid is so important, what it looks like, and how to do it. Dean Spade is an activist in the queer and trans liberation space based in racial and economic justice. He's an associate professor at Seattle University School of Law. Well, Dean Spade, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
This book, Mutual Aid, Building Solidarity During This Crisis and the Next, this crisis being the COVID-19 crisis, is that right?
You know, in my view, the kinds of crises that were on the surface while I was writing that book, you know, were both COVID and the climate crisis and the kinds of disasters it's causing all over, and the housing crisis and the crisis of mass incarceration and racist criminal punishment system and the migrant justice crisis. To me, there's a lot of what I'm thinking about in that book is how many crises we're facing. And so I think that Verso wanted to specifically kind of focus it in their COVID. It came out as part of a 4-book series focused on COVID, but certainly that crisis is one of many, and it has been very much impacted by those other crises, by the crisis of having a for-profit healthcare system, et cetera.
And we are also seeing the climate crisis and the COVID crisis right now as we're talking. Texas and even places closer to you have been having serious problems with their power supply.
Yes, I've been very worried and upset seeing what's going on in Texas. You know, not only that people don't have power, but that they don't have water and can't heat their tainted water because they don't have power. And then also there's a food shortage because the food can't, you know, reach people's communities because the roads are covered in ice and snow. So it's very terrifying. And I think we're going to see not only the acute loss of life in the immediate days around this, but we're going to see long-term consequences to this moment of crisis in Texas.
What kind of long-term consequences are you anticipating?
One thing is that a lot of housing is being destroyed. I've been hearing about, you know, the housing is not designed to have this, the weight of a lot of snow on top of it. So people are having their roofs collapse. I'm sure there's going to be mold problems in a lot of places because of the leaks that are happening throughout people's homes. So there's going to be long-term health effects from that. I think there's likely to be more COVID infections if people are having to seek emergency shelter, emergency services in congregate spaces, or let their neighbors in because there's, you know, their house is caving in or because there's a little more heat. I think that there's often long-term health effects from periods without health care or without electricity, like people who use medical devices that require electricity or who don't, you know, the effects of not getting water when you need it, not getting food when you need it. So I think it's, you know, and also, you know, if we're thinking typically about U.S. infrastructure, we have a terrible system around emergencies and disasters that, you know, if it does fix anyone's home or if it does provide any services, tends to provide them only to people who are the most enfranchised, who are the wealthiest. Like after Hurricane Sandy in New York, the big thing that FEMA offered people was loans for homeowners to fix their houses. Like people don't need loans when they've just been through a disaster. And the people who are not homeowners are usually just completely left out in the cold or ineligible for support. So I think that one of the problems in the US with how we look at crises is we often only care about deaths and we only care about a very short time horizon. And then we don't keep interrogating, well, what happened next? Well, what happened next? And if we look at any of the big disasters that we're all aware of from even just the last 10 years, the fires in California, the different hurricanes, we would see that things remain unfixed. People remain living without the basic things they need, and particularly people who are at the bottom of society.
Yes. And also in Texas, mutual aid networks seem to be springing into action as we speak, swifter than government aid. Have you been keeping up with some of the mutual aid efforts that are happening in Texas?
Yeah, I've been looking at that a bit. And I think that's pretty typical. Like in general, when there are disasters, the thing that's most useful in disaster is immediate support and local knowledge, local wisdom, right? So if the lights go out or the water becomes unavailable on our block, what's most important is who knows who lives on this block, who won't be able to get out of their space because they need an elevator and they're on a high floor, or who knows who has a medical device that requires power, or who knows who stores extra water at their house, or who has a solar battery, those kinds of questions. And so, and even more, you know, and even more elements of that, like if you live in a neighborhood where a particular language is spoken, it would be most useful to have emergency information in that language or whatever the case may be. Like local knowledge is the most effective knowledge for disaster relief. The federal government and even state governments are very bumbling. You know, they show up late. They mostly bring cops and guns and soldiers. They don't really actually bring much relief. And they tend to show up and criminalize people and then have very delayed reactions about getting people any relief. So it's not surprising to see that in Texas. And I think that one of the questions I have about mutual aid and one of the things I've observed is that when we're doing mutual aid, we're also preparing for the next disaster. So an example I often think of is that when Hurricane Sandy hit New York City, there was a group called CAV that's been around for many years that had been already doing a lot of organizing in Chinatown in New York. And so they knew like where were elders. You know, there was no running water, there's no electricity. They knew where were their elders in buildings who would be trapped without water because they actually were in the community and knew people because they were already doing mutual aid work and already doing organizing. So I think one of the things we're seeing, and I'll be curious to hear accounts perhaps you know, in the future from people in Texas, like was any of the COVID mutual aid infrastructure that people had built already helping people support, be more prepared to build support for when this winter weather, unusual winter weather struck, you know, how can we, and I've been thinking a lot too with loss of water. I think one of the main mutual aid projects we need to be doing everywhere is helping people store water or helping figure out on a given block, okay, this person has a basement and could store water. Also for people who live next door in tiny apartments who can't store water, because pretty much every disaster has the danger of having your water tainted and having water lost, whether that's an earthquake, a winter storm effect, a hurricane, et cetera. And so that's the kind of like, when we're deep in mutual aid and like caring and thinking about each other and facing these crises, we're also aware, yeah, like another crisis is probably around the corner. You know, fire season is going to come back. Hurricane season is going to come back. What can we be doing to make sure all of us in our neighborhood or on our block are supported instead of it kind of being like, I'm just out for me, which is, I think, the way that the society often kind of encourages us to be.
We've been talking about mutual aid, and I think people have a general idea of what it means, but how would you define it? What are the key points contained in that term that you want to bring out from this book, Mutual Aid, Building Solidarity During This Crisis and the Next?
I think about mutual aid as the part of social movement work where we are meeting each other's direct needs, survival needs, with a shared understanding that the systems in place have created the crises that we're facing and or are worsening them, and that we need to do it for ourselves. We can't rely on the systems in place to come save us from these crises, which they are creating, whether we're talking about climate crisis or the housing crisis or whatever crises we're talking about at the time. So mutual aid work is really significant to social movements. It's what builds social movements. Most people enter social movements either because they're in need of something and the people in the social movement are giving it out through a mutual aid project. And then they get to go there and talk about, you know, meet people who are thinking about the crisis they're facing, not in terms of blaming them for being in crisis, but instead blaming the systems that produced the crisis. So they get to think about collective action to address their conditions while they also get their immediate survival needs met. Or a lot of people join movements because they're upset and scared and angry about the kinds of crises they see people facing, and they want what they most want to do, because humans have this like beautiful quality in us, is we're like, I want to help right away. I want to help those people. Maybe because I already went through it, or because I love somebody who's been through it, or just because I heard about it on the news or whatever. And so mutual aid is this kind of on-ramp for social movements. It's the key place in which we see large mobilizations because people enter that way. And then I consider it mutual aid when it is tied to other social movement strategies that are about getting to the root causes of those crises. So it's like, we're here directly supporting people in this homeless encampment. And there's some people who are also directly supporting people in housing court, trying to stop evictions or blocking the doors of housing court, as we've seen a lot lately. And we're also part of a housing justice movement in our city or in our state or whatever, that's trying to actually, you know, transfer money from the police budget to housing, you know, or these bigger efforts, and that those things are really tied together. And the way that people come into our movement is often through the immediate needs work. I think that one of the most important things to distinguish in our conversation about mutual aid is that it's not charity. It's really opposed to charity. So charity is the framework that has, you know, long historical roots. Our U.S. charity framework has long historical roots to Europe. And the framework where rich people are controlling resources and trying to extract as much labor from people. And this produces displacement and makes a lot of people poor and itinerant and, you know, unhoused. And so we're going to have a limited thing where we give crumbs to those people and we get a lot of credit as rich people from doing it. Maybe we're doing it because we want to get into heaven. We're doing it so we can get good PR for our corporation or whatever the case may be. And we give that charity in a very conditional way. So, oh, you can get this, but as long as you don't use drugs, or you can get this as long as you take the psych meds, or you can get this if you don't have a felony charge, or you can get this if you are not undocumented, or whatever the case may be. It's very conditional and it's full of eligibility requirements, and it's very stigmatizing. It says, you're poor because there's something wrong with you, and we're going to figure out who the deserving poor are and give them these little crumbs that won't change the system. So charity is system sustaining and blames people in crisis for the crisis, and it's moralizing, whereas mutual aid blames the system and says that everybody deserves everything. And mutual aid projects tend to be really focused on not creating all of these narrow eligibility criteria that are about figuring out who the good poor or the good people in crisis are, but instead saying who's the most vulnerable, who's facing the worst conditions. Let's start there, which is just a real upside down of the charity model.
Yeah, and actually in this book on mutual aid, Dean Spade, you write that the creation of the nonprofit sector that has ballooned in the last half century was a direct response to the threat posed by mass mutual aid work in anti-racist, anti-colonial, and feminist movements of the 1960s and 70s. Say more about that.
I think a lot of us who are alive today just kind of, you know, we're really adapted to the idea that nonprofits are where like social change work happens. And we think that that's sort of always been the case. But actually, most movements, all movements throughout history for liberation and for people's survival have been, the people in them have been unpaid for their work. It's been not a professionalized setting. And it's been based in like lots and lots of mutual aid. One of the examples I often give is the Montgomery bus boycott, right? Like we were told a story in, you know, kind of institutionalized US history that this is a moment where you see like Martin Luther King give a speech and you see these, you know, laws change. But really, when you think about what the Montgomery bus boycott was, it was a lot of Black people, especially women, coordinating a lot of people to get rides, a lot of places so that they wouldn't have to take these buses. Like it was, and it came out of Black feminist anti-rape work because there was so much sexual harassment and assault of Black women on public transit at that time. And so it really shifts our thinking about like, what makes a movement powerful? It's not those individual moments where a law changes or a man makes a speech. It's usually the grassroots mass mobilization of tons and tons of people to care for each other. Like that is the real central piece of this. So I think that's often missed in the way we talk about social change in the United States, which is very much like you should appeal to the law to change things for you. And we should imagine that justice will come from a court or a legislature. But mutual aid is actually the sort of threatening mobilization that's required. So in the 1960s and 70s, as you know, there was, you know, major global anti-colonial uprisings, as well as in the United States, like, you know, the American Indian movement and the Black Liberation movement and the feminist movement and the movement against the war in Vietnam. And it's a big period of intense political upheaval and real political threat to the powers that be. And those movements, if you look at them, they were all doing mutual aid. For example, it was very typical in all of those movements to be doing free health clinics, you know, whether that was feminist health clinics, whether that's groups giving people abortions that were illegal, whether that's people doing sexual health awareness for women who'd been often denied real information about sexual health. You had the Black Panther Party's health programs. They had an ambulance service. They had mobile health clinics. You had the Young Lords, the folks focusing on Puerto Rican liberation, doing health-based work, doing a takeover at Lincoln Hospital focused on the ways in which Puerto Rican people were experiencing violence and harm at that hospital and in general lack of access to health. In every movement, I'm just giving an example of the health-based mutual aid projects, but mutual aid was the bread and butter of those projects. It's the way people got into those movements. And when you, what happens after, the time we live in, which people call neoliberalism, is, the period that's been a reaction to that very disruptive time of uprising in the US and around the world. There was a real attempt to sort of criminalize and control those movements. So you saw what a scholar who I find really useful in this, Dylan Rodriguez, talks about as the carrot and the stick. The stick was that the FBI was infiltrating those movements, was assassinating their leaders, criminalizing their leaders, some of whom are still in prison today. And the carrot was the creation of what we call the nonprofit industrial complex, this new formation where if you do work that is not threatening and root causes oriented like those movements were doing, but instead you do work that's about piecemeal reforms, that's about sort of a charity framework of depoliticized services, then you can get grants from philanthropists. So it's one of the ways in which, in reaction to those disruptive movements, there was kind of a lid put on how social change was framed. And so today we live in a world where people think, oh, if I care about something that's happening and I'm mad because something that Trump is doing or something that's happening in my state or that white supremacists are doing, I should either give to a nonprofit or maybe be one of the few people who creates a career in that or post something on social media or vote. Like, we're really encouraged to have these kinds of non-participatory reactions and connections to the things we care about, to kind of be in passive roles. And the nonprofit system is a part of that. And nonprofits can only do work that they can get funded for by the government or philanthropy because they are working, that's the framework of their work. They don't mobilize tons and tons of people who are unpaid to do big things. They instead focus on, these narrow agendas that a few kind of technocrat elites, people who graduated from fancy schools and are running these nonprofits decide on. And they only get funded if they do things that are palatable to rich people or the government. So it's a very limiting strategy. And so that's why when we look around today at like what grassroots movements are really shaking things, like the movement for Black Lives or the migrant justice movement, the most transformative visions and goals and the kind of action in the streets isn't being led by nonprofits. Nonprofits tend to be behind the curve, more likely to be negotiating a compromise with the government or with elites instead of actually at the forefront of what the demands are that would really meet the crisis. And obviously, there's a lot of nuance that I'm missing here. And I'm not saying that people who work in nonprofits are bad. Obviously, I have worked in nonprofits a lot, but just that there's a structural aim to contain movements through nonprofitization and professionalization. And that's why unpaid grassroots participatory work like mutual aid is a real transformative departure from that kind of framework.
Yes, and talking about participatory, you have some contrasts that you make in the book, like you just did, between charity and mutual aid. Talk about participatory models versus, hierarchy versus horizontalism.
I think that one of the big changes from the period of the 1960s and 70s to now is that one of the lessons learned from that period was about some of the limitations of some of the hierarchical models people were typically using in a lot of groups. That when you have a hierarchical model inside your social movement organization, it's easier for law enforcement to infiltrate and get somebody into a high position and have that person have greater disruption. It's easier for if the government or your opponents can take down, just one, stigmatize or assassinate or whatever, one key person at the top, it makes your group more vulnerable. And when you have hierarchy in social movement organizations, you're gonna see a replay of all the hierarchies we already have in our society. So it's gonna often be men are on top, or white people are on top, or people with disabilities are on bottom, or people with an education end up on top. These kinds of, in a hierarchical structure, we often see even more likelihood for those same patterns of hierarchy from our society to reproduce themselves. And I think a lot of the controversies we've seen in our lifetimes of like sexual abuse inside organizations and things like that are related to that hierarchy. It's like, how do some people come to have kind of protected power and to not get feedback and to be allowed to do harmful things and have nobody stop them because they have some kind of hierarchical power. So because of that, in the last, 30 years in particular, and especially because of the critiques that came from, in particular, Black feminists and other feminists of color, of the problems of how people copy societal norms of hierarchy in their supposedly revolutionary or liberatory organizations. Because of that and those critiques and those experiences, a lot more organizations, and also I think because of, the rise of a certain kind of horizontalism in, especially in Latin American context, in a lot of different social movements, there's been a real shift in, I think, in a lot of US grassroots work to really thinking about how to build horizontal or flat or non-hierarchical organizations, not because we believe we can get away from society's hierarchies. We all bring that with us to the group, no matter what. We were all conditioned by that. But because when we make a commitment to try to make decisions together in a way that takes everyone's concerns into account, instead of having like a majority rule or having just the director decide or just whoever we put on top decide, we end up having more likelihood that we'll actually capture the voices or ideas or wisdom that's usually left out, right? So if we're in a group and we're trying to decide whether or not to do our food distribution on Wednesdays or Thursdays, and we do it by majority rule, and most people in the group are just like, yeah, I like Wednesdays better, but there's two people in the group who are like, that's the same day that the indigenous group in our town has this really important meeting, and it's only two people in our group who care about that, we shouldn't not listen to that. we don't want to outvote what might be actually some of the most important information that might be, or if only one person in the group is affected by this or that because they're the one with a disability, or because they're the one who has kids, or they're the one who lives in public housing, or they're the one who's currently unhoused. Like, we actually really want to hear about how this will impact people who might even be a smaller part of our group, but have wisdom that is particularly important to us if what we're trying to do is prioritize those in the greatest need and prioritize solidarity and connection to other groups and building an important network. And so the skills we get from practicing consensus decision-making, from actually caring about what everyone thinks and trying to massage a proposal until we find a way that everybody thinks is going to work. The benefits to that are really a lot. One of them is that, of course, if you have everyone making a decision together and we're all in a group where people are unpaid, it's much more likely that we're going to implement it, right? Like, if you guys make a decision that I don't like and you outvoted me, I'm just probably not going to do the work, or I'll leave the group, right? Like, people want a say in the work they're doing, especially when they're doing it just for passion and not for pay, right? And so we're trying to get away from coercive dynamics where we only work because we have to work to eat, and instead think about our social movement work as when we're creating new social relations together. And the other thing is, it skills us up. Like, it helps us learn a new way of being together in groups. So instead of being in this meeting and trying to like push my idea through and have my idea be the one that's steamrolled on top of everybody else's, I'm instead like, okay, I've brought my proposal and I want to hear everyone's concerns and disagreements so that we can come up with the best possible idea from the group's wisdom that all of us will be behind and really make happen. And so there's a just like, that's not a well-developed skill in our culture where we are like very afraid of feedback, where people really want to be right. And so I think that that's really like a very meaningful social transformation, that it's part of us like building a new world and new ways of being together.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I'm talking with Dean Spade about his book, Mutual Aid. Now, you mentioned consensus building, which is critical to this structure of, this horizontalism, but leadership is also really important. I have been in, organizations where nobody wants to take leadership, and so nobody does, and, things get kind of flaky. So talk about leadership and what makes for good leadership within this kind of participatory democracy.
Yeah. In the book, I have a chart about this. I've really enjoyed making a lot of like charts and bullets and stuff in this book to try to make it readable and skimmable and a useful tool for people on the ground. And the chart about leadership is just trying to distinguish like what we've been taught leadership is inside like capitalist, dominance focused, hierarchical culture versus what leadership might look like if we really are centering like mutuality, like everyone's participation. So I think that there's a lot of elements to that, but the sort of dominant norms in a racist, capitalist, patriarchal society about what leadership is are about like my way or the highway, strength through domination, not necessarily having very good listening skills, being really good at sort of pushing and forcing people to do something on your timeline, I mean, we can think about, when I think about it, I just think about like toxic masculinity is kind of the model, right? And the kinds of leadership we need, and also leadership, that kind of leadership can be really about like getting credit and being like the face, like everyone's working for this, but I'm the company owner. And so it's all my work, you know, like just that kind of like Jeff Bezos versus like all the people who actually work at the Amazon, you know, warehouses who are being treated so poorly or whatever, or the difference between Walmart workers and the family that owns Walmart, right? So in mutual aid work and in social movement work that's trying to seek liberation, we really think about leadership differently, right? So that like what makes me an excellent leader is that I'm producing more and more leadership in others. Like that's ultimately like what I want to do. What we want our organizations to do is mobilize more and more people and have more and more people have the skills and capacities to like fully bring their political vision into the group and into other groups. Like that's, it's not about like me being the important celebrity activist or whatever. It's about how did I facilitate other people's leadership, which, you know, has a lot of different qualities. Like that means welcoming other people and wanting to hear about them instead of just wanting to be right and be heard. It means, being like attentive to group dynamics and caring about how people are feeling and doing, which of course, like in the toxic masculinity world, like that is absolutely not it. You know, wanting to make sure everyone felt heard in the group, wanting to make sure there was follow through. And, you know, you were talking about people being flaky. So like, you know, not being flaky, like being accountable, but meaning like trying to be accountable to the group's mission, not like my whims as a individualist leader, which I think is often what it looks like when it's like, there's just an executive director and they're like, now we're going to focus on this. Now we're going to focus on this. And all the workers underneath them have to just go with it, whether or not that's what they think would be the most strategic thing. So it's a lot about redefining leadership. And to say that there's a lot of different ways that can look. And I think, you know, in recent years, people have talked a lot about like how we want and need leaderless movements, or people often call them leaderful movements. So instead of being like, who's the chair of the committee? It's like, well, how is everybody in this group co-stewarding this group's work and mission, and everyone's doing leadership? And there's lots of ways to do that. So some people might be making more speeches than others, or some people might be creating more spreadsheets than others, or some people might be changing more diapers than others, but all of those things are the work of leaders. And so it's a real shift from the idea of leadership as like something like a couple of people leading a bunch of followers. It's like, that's not it. It's instead about how do we be people growing machines that help more and more people meaningfully participate in liberation work they care about, which might mean that they like got skilled up on how to notice disability justice issues in the group, or it might be that they got skilled up on like how to use social media, or it might be that they got skilled up on how to facilitate a meeting in an inclusive way, or how to facilitate conflict. There's, you know, there's so many different pieces of that. But I think it's a pretty big distinction between the way we've been told leadership looks in an authoritarian society.
Well, that is a great answer. And there is so much more in this book, Mutual Aid, Building Solidarity During This Crisis and the Next. A really useful book. Dean Spade, thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice about this. I feel like this is the kind of book that people can really use as a guide.
Well, thanks for saying that. I'm really glad to talk to you.
You can find links to excerpts from Mutual Aid at writersvoice.net, as well as more material that Dean Spade has put together to help people build their own mutual aid networks. Next up, what we don't know about domestic violence can kill us. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. In 2019, we interviewed Rachel Louise Snyder about her groundbreaking book, No Visible Bruises, What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us. Domestic partner violence was on the rise then, after 4 decades of decline. But now, with the COVID pandemic, the problem has only gotten worse. Let's listen to that 2019 interview with Rachel Louise Snyder now. After almost 4 decades of decline, murder among romantic partners is now on the rise. In 2017, there were over 2,000 such deaths. The vast majority of the victims are women, but their children as well. That's what happened to a friend and her children of my guest, Rachel Louise Snyder. Snyder was on tour promoting her acclaimed new book about intimate partner violence when she got the news that her friend had been murdered by her husband, who then turned the gun on himself. It was a terrible shock and irony for Snyder. whose book No Visible Bruises gives context to the epidemic of domestic violence. She frames her account of the scale of the epidemic around key stories that explode the common myths that if things were bad enough, victims would just leave, that shelter is an adequate response, and most insidiously, that violence inside the home is a private matter, sealed from the public sphere and disconnected from other forms of violence. Through the stories of victims, perpetrators, law enforcement, and reform movements from around the country, Snyder explores the real roots of private violence, its far-reaching consequences for society, and what it will take to truly address it. In addition to No Visible Bruises, Rachel Louise Snyder is the author of Fugitive Denim, a moving story of people and pants in the borderless world of global trade, and the novel What We've Lost Is Nothing. Her print work has appeared in The New Yorker, The New York Times Magazine, Slate, and many other venues. Well, Rachel Louise Snyder, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is just such an important book, No Visible Bruises, What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us. First of all, the term domestic violence, you use that term, but you prefer another term, intimate partner terrorism. Tell us about that.
Well, the biggest problem is that domestic violence is such an abstraction as a term. It doesn't really capture what it feels like to be inside that kind of a relationship. And I'll give you an example. There's a woman in my book named Michelle, and her husband used to take the kids if she did something that upset him. He would take them and go camping for the night or go to a motel, and she would be just frantic with worry. So the kids were used as sort of coercion to keep her in line. And that's not unusual. You know, that it's really the anticipated terror of pain and physical injury or what could happen that really, I think, is so difficult to live with for people who are in this situation. Another thing he did was at one point he went and got a rattlesnake from outside their town. They lived in Billings, Montana, and he brought it home and kept it in a cage and told her he would put it in bed with her or in the shower with her. And so I don't know what to call that. It's not physical violence, but is it living under a kind of terror? I think it is. And so I just think intimate terrorism is a more apt description of what it's like to live inside of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And the case you're talking about there is that of Michelle Monson Moser. Tell us more about what happened to her.
She met Rocky when she was 14 and he was 24. So this is not an unusual scenario to have a very young girl in this case, or a very young victim, or have a significant age gap between them. And, you know, she fell in love. She was pregnant by 15. She had two kids by the time she graduated from high school. And she was very determined to not be a statistic, to not be one of those, you know, young teenage girls who gets pregnant and then, you know, her life is ruined. Like, she really wanted to have a family, make it work. And he slowly began to wrest control and agency away from her. So, for example, he didn't want her to have friends over because he said it was a bad influence on the kids. And he didn't like hanging around with her family because he said that they didn't like him, which was true, right? He had gotten her pregnant at 15. I mean, he wasn't wrong about that, but it was this slow erosion of agency that you see that is so common, and it happened in their relationship as well.
And this was a very important case for you. How does this case of Michelle Monson-Moser illuminate some of our misconceptions about victims of domestic violence? And maybe just start out by saying, what are some of the common misconceptions about victims of intimate terrorism or domestic violence?
You know, one of the questions that we always ask is, why didn't she just leave? Why didn't the victim just leave? And, you know, first of all, that puts the impetus for change on the victim rather than on the person who's actually perpetrating the crime. So it's a problematic question. But the other problem is that they do leave, and they leave all the time. It's just that we don't recognize what leaving looks like. So in the case of Michelle Moser, you know, once she realized that things were only going to get worse with Rocky, that, like, you know, his abuse was only going to get worse, she knew that she couldn't just up and leave with the kids, right? She couldn't move to a different state. When, you know, you have to enroll kids in school and, you know, there's parental rights involved. And so she knew she couldn't just up and leave with them. So instead she did things like, she had the house was owned by her father and they rented it from him. So she had her father put the house in her name secretly so that she could eventually get Rocky kicked out. And he wouldn't let her work outside the home, but she was taking classes at Montana State University to become a nurse with an eye toward being able to support her kids at some point, because she knew that she'd have to have a job, right? And so she was putting all these things in place. But it's a long-term process. It's not an event. And what we discovered, or what was discovered in the aftermath of Michelle, Rocky eventually shot their kids and shot himself in November of 2001. And what we discovered, I think, or what the state discovered, was that there were so many small changes that could have been made in her situation that would have helped. I mean, we can't say for sure, like, yes, it would have kept her alive. But for example, the police only were called one time on Rocky, and that was by Michelle's mother. And they came to the house, and Rocky had broken in, taken his older daughter, and then taken her camping for the night, taken her to a motel, sorry. And Michelle, of course, was frantic with worry. And for the first time ever, she began to tell her mother of these years of abuse that she suffered at Rocky's hands. And so her mother's the one who called the police. And the police came and they said, well, what do you want us to charge him with? It's his own daughter. You know, he wasn't charged with breaking and entering. He had hit Michelle's sister and left pretty significant bruising and cuts on her to try to get at his daughter, you know, endangering the life of a minor. There's all kinds of things he could have been charged with. Instead, they were going to charge him with criminal mischief. And Michelle went and filed a restraining order. When Rocky came back, he got arrested, but his parents bailed him out almost immediately. He called them and he manipulated them and convinced them that, you know, he knew he was wrong and he wouldn't do it again and he had a right to his kids, and they believed him. And so they bailed him out. And as soon as Michelle found out that he had been bailed out, she was back at the DA's office recanting everything. She said she'd made it up about the snake. She said it was them against the state. She didn't want to press charges. And all of this, we know now, the recanting and all of that, has to do with the idea that she's trying to negotiate with someone that she knows is dangerous and who is now dangerous and enraged, which was Rocky. The state of Montana, if you are arrested for domestic violence today, you will not be able to bail out first thing in the morning like Rocky did. You cannot see a judge until the afternoon. And it's such a small thing, but what it does is give domestic violence advocates a little bit of time to get to a victim, to create a safety plan, to maybe change locks, to get an abuser possibly on GPS, to put all kinds of things in place, right, so that what happened with Michelle and Rocky doesn't happen again, hopefully.
Yeah, in fact, you say in the book that as tragic as it was, her death actually saved a lot of lives. What do you mean by that?
So there were all kinds of small suggestions that came out of her death that what's called the fatality review team in the state of Montana recommended. And these fatality review teams exist all over the country. Most states have them, I think all, but just a very few handful. And they exist for this very purpose. They exist to look at domestic violence homicides and figure out gaps in the system at the statewide level. So in the state of Montana, where Michelle was killed, one of the changes they made was to not let abusers bail out first thing in the morning. Another one is they created something called the Hope Card. So an active restraining order most often is printed on paper and victims get one and they have to carry that one around with them. And what they found was that, you know, paper disintegrates or a victim forgets the restraining order at home or because it's on paper becomes illegible for whatever reason. And there was a woman actually killed as a result of a police officer not being able to read that her restraining order was active. This was around the same time as Michelle's death. And so they created what's called the Hope Card, which is a credit card sized restraining order that is laminated, that has a picture of the abuser, the active dates of the restraining order, any exclusion zones that the abuser is not allowed to enter. And victims can get 20 of these cards if they want to. They can pass them around at their kids' school. They can pass them around at their place of work. They can pass them around to their clergy at church, right? Anywhere that they're supposed to go. So again, in the case of Michelle and Rocky, a neighbor saw him peering in the windows of his house at some point before he killed the whole family. That's the kind of thing where had that neighbor had a copy of the restraining order, the Hope card, she would have seen, oh, he's not supposed to be there right now. I'm going to call the police. But she didn't know that. So it's really, I mean, a lot of the changes are really small and they seem insignificant, but they end up having a really huge ripple effect on individual cases.
Yeah. And let's take just a little step back for a moment and talk about the scope of this kind of intimate terrorism that you speak about in this book, Rachel Snyder, No Visible Bruises. What is the scope? Who is most likely to be a victim, if that's even known? And is it getting worse?
Well, you know, it depends on your marker, actually. I mean, there's a couple different ways I could answer that. You know, one thing that emerged only after the book was published, that came out in the middle of May. There's a Northeastern University professor out of Boston who keeps stats on domestic violence homicides in this country. And according to his statistics, since 2017, domestic violence homicides are on the rise by more than 30% in this country, by something like 33%. Now, you can look at that and say, my God, it's definitely getting worse. I mean, just the sheer numbers. But you can also look at that and say 2017 was when the Me Too movement really began to gain momentum. And I think that there is an aspect of retaliatory violence to that. And so another way of looking at those that those chilling numbers is to say women are no longer, women are particularly the victims. Women are no longer being silent about this. Women are no longer going to stand by while, you know, a Jeffrey Epstein takes victim after victim after victim, right? We're not going to stand for it anymore. And so I think on the one hand, the numbers are grim. On the other hand, I think that women's rage and women's movements are being galvanized in a way that we just haven't seen in a long time. I think the other part of that question, who is a victim, is a lot more difficult to answer. You know, I don't think I interviewed a single person who was a victim of domestic violence who didn't say some version of like, I'm not your typical victim to me. No one thinks of themselves as a typical victim, whatever that means. And I think in part because domestic violence doesn't happen sort of overnight in a vacuum, right? It happens within the, like it did with Rocky and Michelle, with this kind of slow erosion of agency. You know, one of the things that I talk about in the book with Rocky and Michelle is he had done recordings, videotape recordings of their family throughout the years. And her father gave me a copy. It was about 14 hours of recordings. And in the early years, when the kids were really little, you'd see them, you know, as babies on the tapes or whatever. Rocky would wake up Michelle by throwing the covers off her. And then he would pan like up her legs and to her rear. And she was really beautiful. She had a beautiful figure. And in the beginning, you could see her say, stop it, that kind of joking around that we're still in love voice, you know, like this lover's teasing. And then as you see the kids start to get older and Rocky continues to do that, she hated to be videotaped. You can see her getting angrier and she says like, stop it, cut it out. She's getting a little more, you know, vehement with him filming her essentially in the nude or in underwear. And he never stops, right? And he laughs at her, he insults her. And then in the a tape that was one of the very last tapes they took just a couple of months before they died, they're hiking together as a family and he does it again. And the kids are older now and he pans up her legs and he makes some joke on the tape about like, hey kids, look at your mom's power there. Look at that, you know, rear or whatever he says. And she doesn't say a thing. And I think there in a nutshell is a loss of agency. There's no physical violence that happens that is apparent in those tapes. And yet what you see is a loss of agency. He's disrespecting her. He doesn't listen to her. and she just gives up trying at some point. And so it's not so much that there's a typical victim as that there's a typical narrative that these relationships all follow, no matter who you are, no matter if you're rich or poor, black, white, from this culture or a different culture, that the narrative is almost always the same.
One of the researchers of this, someone I actually know from way back, is Evan Stark, who said, who talked about coercive control. Evan Stark was very involved in the anti-domestic violent movement in New Haven.
Yeah. There's a question about whether he coined the term coercive control, but he certainly defined it. He's got a book written about it. And coercive control, which is exactly what we're talking about when we talk about taking the kids for a night or threatening somebody with a rattlesnake, right? Coercive control is one of the most insidious forms of domestic violence. And in fact, there are laws against coercive control in the UK, in France, and now most recently in Ireland. And I know that New York and California, there's some lawmakers who are looking into the possibility of putting forth a bill about coercive control. But so far in this country, we don't really have any movement. And it's that coercive control that is, I think, the most insidious when we're talking about domestic violence.
Going back to the victims not being typical at all, you yourself were on book tour when you got the news that a friend of yours had been murdered.
Yeah. Well, and it's even a little more complicated than that. It's one of my closest friend's brothers murdered his wife and then himself. And I knew the couple, the woman killed, her name was Lola, and Jason, the brother of my friend, because my daughter went to school with their older daughter and is good friends with their very good close friends. So it shook the whole community, but it also shook me sort of personally. I got off a plane in the middle of this book tour and thought, I can't, like, this is a savage irony. And it's only been a month since that happened. So in some ways, my circle of friends are still sort of wrapping our heads around it. Like, we knew them both, you know, we know their kids. They both worked for, you know, they were foreign service diplomats. And, they both knew about my book. I mean, they both were invited to the book release party in DC where we all live. Yeah. I don't even know what to say about it. Just that it's, you know, his sister has like been incredible. And she's like, this is what you do. You have to keep talking about it. It's hard though.
I can imagine. And so talk about, you know, some of the other aspects of, you know, the kind of characterological factors that create this kind of terrorism, mostly among men. I mean, not exclusively, but the vast majority is practiced by men.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And it's, I mean, there are certain aspects that are typical. You know, when we think of abusers, we think like rageaholic, or we think, oh, I'd be able to recognize it. I'm educated. I'm whatever, you know, I'm self-aware. And yet only about 25% of abusers fit that rageaholic definition. The other 75% know perfectly well how to act in society. They're not raging at their boss or their coworkers. They're not, you know, necessarily out there with road rage. So it's an issue of, for them anyway, it's an issue of power and control. They tend to be profoundly, deeply narcissistic. I don't mean like, you know, your garden variety scent, you know, I'm great, the center of the universe. I mean, almost like a clinical diagnosis of narcissism disorder. They tend to be very black and white thinkers. You know, it's my way or the highway. They tend to feel kind of eternally underappreciated for, you know, like they always feel sort of shortchanged in their relationship. She doesn't appreciate what I do, blah, blah, blah. That kind of narrative runs through this. But even the abusers, you know, I sat in on batterers intervention groups really around the country, and so many of them were like made up of guys that were normal, right? That I would have like gone out for a beer with. Like, there was nothing about them that was like telltale to me in any way. And it was really unsettling because it made me realize like any of us could find ourselves in this kind of situation. And you invest years of your life in a relationship, and then suddenly someone's insulting you. You're not going to walk away at the first sign of distress. You know, these are complicated relationships.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with journalist Rachel Louise Snyder about intimate partner violence in the U.S. Her book is No Visible Bruises: What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us. Yes, I know. In fact, I was a victim of domestic violence. I did leave after the second time I got hit because, you know, my mother, in fact, said, "You've got to leave him because he'll do it again." But when I told other people about it, they said, "Really? He just seems so nice."
Yeah, yeah. I know, right? I mean, that's the thing is like they, and I'm so happy that you got out and that you were able to listen to your mother. But, you know, I mean, so often it's like, this is happening in a much larger context. It might be someone that you share children with, right? It might be someone that you, certainly someone that you have many, many happy memories and maybe even just some mediocre memories, right? But like relationships aren't made up of one violent act after another or one coercive act after another, right? You've got Christmases together or Hanukkahs or other holidays. You've got trips together. You've got, you know, you've got all this other context of him being nice or him being remorseful or him being, you know, conciliatory or whatever. So it does take quite a lot to extract oneself from a relationship like this. And I also think it's important to point out that there's, you know, there's abuse and then there's really dangerous, high risk domestic violence situations that can become homicide. And I think it's important to kind of like think about those differently, right? Not everybody who leaves is going to be in danger of being killed. They just need to kind of bide their time because, you know, this violence tends to exist on a scale. So the first 90 days, says the research, you know, risk is a little higher. And then after 90 days, it begins to drop off a little bit, but it stays relatively high for the first year. So sometimes it's a matter of building protections around a victim for enough time that it takes, you know, it takes her, the ending of her relationship to kind of play its course out emotionally.
So you're saying the most dangerous time is within 90 days after leaving the abuser.
After leaving, yeah.
So these, the abuser programs, it was very interesting. The part of the book, the second part of the book that really goes into, you know, focuses on the men and treatment of them. You know, a lot of people are sent to anger management, which never seemed to me to work very well. You talk about a program that sounds very effective, the RSVP program. Tell us about the RSVP program and Jimmy Espinoza.
Yes. So, you know, the efficacy of any offenders intervention program is, you know, some are certified, some are not, some have very weak certifications. I've been asked, you know, while I've been on my book tour, like, who did you write this book for? And I, you know, my answer is like, everyone. I think everyone should read it, of course. But I also think that judges in particular need to read it for exactly what you're talking about, because so often anger management is conflated with batterer's intervention. And that is where we get that deep misunderstanding of like, well, we would recognize a rageaholic, right? But you're not working with a rageaholic when you're working with a batterer most of the time. So I think it's important to kind of talk about those things separately. The RSVP program is different than other offender intervention programs. It uses a curriculum called Man Alive, and it's in a particular jail in San Francisco County called the San Bruno Jail that has a dedicated domestic violence wing. So everyone who's in there has domestic violence in their background in some sense as abusers. It may not be the main primary reason they're in prison, but they get into this wing because of this, because of their domestic violence history. And so it's 5 days a week, the RSVP program, about 6 hours a day. It used to be longer, and it lasts for about a year. And it's really an incredible program. Researchers looked at the way that they ran this program, and they found an 85% drop in recidivism rates with guys who completed the program, not started it. They had to complete the whole year. But that's a pretty impressive number. The problem, of course, is that it costs money. And in this country, we don't think of prison as a place to rehabilitate people. We think of prison as a place to lock people up and forget about them. And so we're perpetrating this cycle of violence over and over and over again. And unfortunately, RSVP, which has been running for like 20 years, has been replicated almost nowhere because it's expensive to run.
And effective, though.
And effective. I mean, it's not perfect, right? You're still dealing with human beings and you're still dealing with very violent men. So they did have an RSVP guy who was taking their classes get out of prison. He didn't finish the program, but he got out before he finished and he ended up, you know, killing his partner. And it was incredibly devastating for everyone involved. So, you know, I think we have to remember that we are always dealing with some element of unpredictability. But for a lot of these guys, you know, and restorative justice is a big part of their curriculum. For a lot of these guys, it's the first time they've ever like had a sense of how their violence affects someone else's life. It's the first time they've, for example, deconstructed a moment of violence to figure out what they look like to someone else externally, right? Like their voice raises, their fists clench, their muscles tense up, right? Like a lot of men in this situation are very intimidating. And it's also really stunning to them to learn that they are the products of a culture that has a certain set of expectations about their behavior as well. Like so many of these guys, like, again, it's, you know, they're narcissistic. So they think they are who they are because of, you know, how they want to be. And in fact, they learn through gender education that culture expects a certain behavior out of them as much as it does women. And that's really shocking and sort of mind blowing to a lot of them.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's a culture of toxic masculinity, and your description of it is really wonderful. Rachel Louise Snyder in No Visible Bruises, just the description of how they deconstruct that idea of male privilege and bring out the sense of what it means to be intimate as opposed to coercive of somebody.
I know. Exactly. You can't just sort of demystify behavior. You have to offer a different set of skills, right? And so one of the things that I think offender intervention programs do that are more successful are offer not just intimacy skills, but I've seen them offer parenting classes, for example, or, you know, further gender education, right? I mean, it's a matter of sort of educating from all angles. And so the most successful ones are the ones that really try to attempt to replace those behaviors with other types of behavior, right? Like, this is one way to be in the world, but here's another way to be in the world.
That was Rachel Louise Snyder talking with us in 2019 about her book, No Visible Bruises. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter @writersvoice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.